About it. I don't know. But, so keep that in mind. So he might call you into question on some of the things we talked about. So we're in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And we're talking about, ultimately, overall the passage there from 1 to verse 12. And we're going to go ahead and open there to 2 Thessalonians 2. And I'm going to go ahead and read the first 12 verses, and then we're going to discuss some. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to Him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first. And the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? And now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this reason God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And he'll go on, as I'm sure Brian will deal with, 13 through 17 is about standing fast or being faithful to God in throughout these trials, throughout these situations, and ultimately in the sanctification of the Word and in our lives through Christ. But here, what we talked about last week, ultimately the issue, as we saw in the first two verses, is that there is a lot of conspiracy, a lot of talk going around the congregation, ultimately around the world, it seems, concerning whether Christ had come yet. And there are issues that some individuals were claiming that the Christ had come, that they'd received a letter, potentially, or they'd manufactured a letter that seemed to be from either the apostles or Paul himself, and that they were using Paul's name or the other apostles' names to try to justify this teaching that the day of Christ had come. Now, if we connect this back to what has already been talked about in 2 Thessalonians as well as 1 Thessalonians 4 and 5, it seems to be talking about the resurrection ultimately, the last day when the world ultimately would end and the saints would be taken back home. And so there were individuals that were teaching that day had already come, that the resurrection had already come. And he says that I don't want you to be ignorant of what's going on. He's already kind of used this same speech, these same kind of phrases. And in verse 3 he says that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. So, we notice that his main thrust, this main focus of this passage here, is not on the man of sin, it's not on the falling away, it's not on the son of perdition, or the man, or the lawless one that he'd be talking about in just a minute. In fact, his entire focus is all on reminding them and encouraging them that the day of Christ had not come yet. And that's it. Now, he would use these other things to kind of propel into other talks, but his main point is that Christ has not already come. And he uses these three arguments to prove it. That you know that God doesn't lie, and that God has said some things that will happen, which means, you know, that they're going to happen. And we had made connection to, especially even today, how do we know that Christ hasn't come yet? Well, in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10, when the day of the Lord comes as a thief of the night, the heavens will pass away with a fervent heat, right? And the elements will melt away with fire. And we looked around, and it's all still here. So we know one thing, that the Lord hasn't come yet, at least in the respect that we were looking for at the end of times. So 2 Peter chapter 3 verse 10, we're not there yet. Now, other things that Jesus has talked about have in fact come to pass. Other things that the Bible talks about that were prophesied have come to pass. But this particular thing in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10, I'm going to use Paul's argument and go, we're all still here, so it hasn't happened yet. But beyond that, that's pretty much his argument. We did discuss the falling away, which was our first aspect, and we noticed that in Paul's writings, which would have happened about 20 years before John's writings, in Paul's writings he talks about the future something happening, and in John's writings, in 1 John chapter 2, if you notice on your sheet there, he calls it the last hour because many antichrists have already come, right? So he, it feels like, or at least it seems, as far as John is concerned, he is looking at something to have already transpired, right? Part of this, maybe not this prophecy specifically in 2 Thessalonians 2, but he is looking at some things that have already taken place that are leading up to him and his idea. This is the last day, or these are the last hours, right? We are part of the end times now, you could say. And as if there's nothing left to wait on other than Christ. Does that make sense? Okay. Alright, so then we talked about who is the man of sin. And we're going to flip the page over because I have a chart here. I love charts. I say that a lot because it's true. So various passages here in 2 Thessalonians 2 give us clues to the man of sin, to the son of perdition, to the lawless one. And if you read the passage through again, I think you'll see that they seem to be speaking of the same person. He talks about the man of sin and the son of perdition in the same breath. And then later on, as he's describing what it seems like he's talking about the man of sin, he calls him also the son of perdition, or the lawless one, I should say. So if we take them all to be the same individual and not three select individuals, it makes it a little easier, at least to see what's going on here. And there's no real reason not to, as far as the way the language is being used. So in verse 3, we'll read it again. He says, "Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition." Now if we skip down to verse 5, we have a small problem because, as we talked about before, we're listening to half a conversation. Really, we're listening to a quarter of the conversation. Because in verse 5 he says, "Do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things." So Paul's already had a conversation with them. And imagine me and Mr. Jim, we have a conversation and you all get to hear me, right? Mr. Jim's in the other room and we're talking and you can hear me talking, but we're talking about a previous conversation. So you've only heard now one quarter of the conversation. You haven't even heard half the conversation and you're trying to piece things together. That's pretty much where we're at here with Paul. Paul says, "I already talked to you about these things. You should know this man of sin, the son of perdition, this lawless one. You should know what you're looking for. You should know, right, not necessarily when it's going to happen, potentially, but that these things are going to take place. You should know this already." In verse 4, he says that this, the man of sin, the son of perdition, opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. Now, hang on a second right there. Opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God. Now, that would, in the grandest scheme, be called blasphemy, literally. That's literally what the word means, to oppose or stand in to replace God. And he says this individual or this entity, this person, this group of people, whatever the man of sin is not only opposed to, but stands in the place of God, or tries to anyway, though no human being, no group of human beings ever could do that. They sure do try, don't they? He says, "or that is worshipped." So it's not just about God. And it's important to notice that. It's not just someone who is opposed to God. He's also opposed not only to God, but to anything that people worship. And especially in the time period that you're talking about here with Paul. And you notice, if you would go back to his sermon on Mars Hill, right? In the context of that whole speech, that whole sermon is all about the gods that are just lining up on that mount, right? On that hill. And there, and he's probably just looking around and he sees one particular, right? The statue of the unknown God. And he plays off of that, but he's looking around and there's all these gods. So it's not just about the God of heaven and earth that we understand him to be, or that the Jews understood him to be. It would be all gods, right? All forms of deity, all things that could potentially be worshipped. He is setting himself above and opposing himself to everything that could possibly be worshipped. If we keep going in verse 4, he says, "So that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." And this is an interesting phrase because it can be taken two different ways. You could, of course, apply it the way traditionally we do. Not we as Christians, but as human beings do. to just apply it to our understanding and go, oh, well, he's talking about God. He's being said either in the temple, right? And that would be the easiest interpretation of it. And go, oh, well, he's stationing himself in the temple because that's where God dwells. But remember what he's already said. He said it's not just about the God of heaven and earth, is it? It's about all gods, all things that could be worshipped, right? Where are things ultimately worshipped?
In temples.
And what are temples?
Man-made.
Ultimately man-made, but if you take it to the extreme, remember in our study of Revelation. In Revelation, he uses a word from the Old Testament, and he says temple. What does he mean by temple?
Body.
What's that?
Body.
The body? Yeah. The body of Christians, right? I mean, there's a metaphor here that he's kind of using, I think, anyway, as he's talking here in 2 Thessalonians, when he says where God dwells, and that G isn't necessarily capitalized. That's the problem. And I think we talked about this last week.
Heart?
I think it's the heart. I think it's the heart of men. Where are idols ultimately worshipped? Now you could say physically they're worshipped at temples, they're worshipped on the mountaintops, they're put on altars. We have idols all over the place, don't we? Even Paul talks about covetous being an idol, right? Idolatry. And so he makes that comparison. And we make the mistake here when we capitalize the G, when we capitalize the H, because that's not in the original Greek. Right? That's supplied by the translators. Right? That's an interpretation that they're talking about God in this context, the one we understand instead of the little g God as we would use it normally. So when we talk about it, what we've got to deal with is that it doesn't seem like he's talking about the God of heaven and earth. He's talking about the gods of anything, right? And mankind doesn't ultimately have one location with which they worship anything other than the one we all worship, everything we ever worship. And that would be our hearts, right? And that's the application you had there in Revelation. When he said temple, he's not talking about the physical temple. He's talking about ultimately the church, but where things are actually happening, which is in the heart of Christians, right? That's what we're fighting over. That's what God is fighting these people over. He's trying to win over their hearts, right? It's not about a physical place. It's not about a mountaintop or a location in Jerusalem. It's about the heart. And I think that's what ultimately he's talking about. That this individual or this group of people, whatever the man of sin, the son of perdition is, he's fighting over men's hearts, right? He wants to be worshipped in the way that every true thing that's ever worshipped is worshipped. And that's with the whole self of an individual. And so we go on, he says, as God in the temple of God, sits in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And so he's expressing his godliness in some form or fashion. In fact, in a few verses he would elaborate on that. In verse 6, because we read verse 5, talking about, Paul's already talked about these things. And I wish he'd include, like, annotation here and tell us exactly what he means by that and the conversation that he had, right? Just pin it to the side of his page so that we could know the conversation that you already had with the Thessalonians and we could be that much further along. But in verse 6 he says, and now you know that is restraining him. Now you know what is restraining, that he may be revealed in his own time. So it is looking forward, obviously. And so something is restraining him. And that something the transcribers seem to believe is divinity for some reason or another, because they capitalize the he's later on, even though it's what I'm looking for. Suspicious whether it is it or not, but something is restraining this one that is going to be revealed on his own time, which means he's coming and he's not going to be motivated by anyone incoming. Okay? So he's not yet, obviously, because Paul says that this day's not going to come until these things come. So it's future tense anyway. And something is restraining it. Verse 7, he says, for the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. There we go. Excuse me. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. So there's an individual or a group of individuals who are pursuing lawlessness, which the context of lawlessness we would use in the Bible, we'd call it sin, right, or iniquity. But here he just uses lawlessness, and he's not respecting, or it's beginning. You can watch it in its inception, right? As it's progressing along, it's almost like you could, you know, you could step back from the world and you could look down and you could watch it grow, almost like a plant. Almost like what we, again, talked about in Revelation, the grapes of wrath that are, you know, that are growing up, that are being cultivated by the sin and iniquity of Rome. And so you can watch that over time, and it seems Paul's talking about that. You watch it over time grow. The mystery of lawlessness is already at work, he says. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. Whatever it is that's restraining this, that's holding it back, right? It's still growing, but something is stifling its growth. Something is keeping it down. And that could be God, that could be the Holy Spirit, that could be some element of divinity. But it doesn't say that. All it says is that something is holding this lawless one back. Something is holding the floodgates, you might say, holding them closed, right? Like any great medieval war movie, right? You've always got a battle over a fort or a castle, and the last stand is always that door that they're trying to hold closed, right? And so everybody's bracing against that door, trying to keep it closed, and everyone outside is beating on it with axes and, you know, and storming the castle and everything. And that's ultimately what's happening here. That this iniquity, this sin, this lawlessness is growing and growing, and something is holding it back, and it will hold it back until it's taken away. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? It'll hold it back until that thing that's holding it back doesn't hold it back anymore. This is the way Paul speaks, though. It's the word I'm looking for. It's almost an essence of Hebrew poetry, where he'll say something, and then he'll say it again in a slightly different way to emphasize the point. So he says in verse 8, "And when the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming." Again, Lord being capitalized and his being capitalized. It's not there in the original Greek. That's not to say that it shouldn't be capitalized, as we would understand the capitalization, but that it doesn't necessarily mean it's capitalized. So our first inclination, we read that, we say, oh, Jesus is coming. Jesus is coming is what he's talking about. And Jesus is coming, right, because we see Lord there capitalized. We go, oh, Lord, capitalized, that means Jesus. Christos isn't here. If it were, that would be easy. And the word for Messiah. Yeah, Jesus. Not here. If it were, that'd be easy, right? But it's the word Adonai. And the word Adonai just means Lord. It just means one who rules over stuff. And it could be anything from what you have even in the New Testament. An individual who is a master over servants is called a lord, according to servants. Individuals who own a household are called lords. And it's the same word. And it's not, again, capitalized in the Greek as it is in the English, at least our translation, anyway, most of them. Some of them don't do that, which I'm always looking out for. So he says, "The Lord, the Adonai, will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming." So this lawless one is going to have effect for a time, but then for a while, or at least after a while, it's going to be taken out of the way. And in verse 9 he says, "The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders." Here in verse 9 you have two elements that we're going to be interested in. One, it tells you the source of this issue, the source of the lawless one, the one who's not going to abide by the rules, you could say. And the source of the lawless one is who? Satan. I gave you a hint with who. I could have said what, but yeah, it's Satan. "And with it will come three things." Yes. Power, signs, and false or lying wonders. That's going to be important as we go forward. So he's giving you some information now. Now we're really getting into something that's going to be worthwhile in our understanding of who this could or could not be. And he says, "And with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they might be saved." Now, he makes an interesting point here, Paul does, that this individual or this group of individuals that is coming is not only going to be deceiving, they're going to have lying wonders, they're going to have what seem to be powers, real and true powers, they're also going to lead people into deception. But it's going to be a specific group of people. Now, it's a very large group of people, but they're going to deceive a large group of people, and it's going to exclude some other people. Now, who are the ones that are going to be deceived? Exactly. Those who are perishing. And by implication with what he says right afterwards, those who do not love hearing the truth. Right? Which would exclude whom? Christians. So Christians are going to be exempt from the... They're not going to listen to the ramblings and the babblings of this individual or this group. Okay? So that's an important aspect too, that it's not going to be overpowering or overwhelming, that people who want to listen to it will, which is generally the case with everything, isn't it? And the people who don't want to listen to it, they're not going to be deceived by it. And for this reason, verse 11, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie. And that's kind of a scary aspect. That God allows people to listen to things that they shouldn't if they want to. He allows them to go off on their own if that's their decision. Romans chapter 1, it's a scary chapter when you're talking about the amount of sin in the world and how God allows people to go off and do their own thing if that's what they choose. He does so many things to hold people back from iniquity and from sin, and yet if their heart is set on it, there's nothing God can do, or at least there's nothing God is willing to go to the extent of doing. Right? He gives us free will so that we can choose to love Him or we can choose to despise Him and reject Him. And so God allows them to go off on their own. In verse 12 He says that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And as we'll talk about this in just the near future, remember that, and I'm going to go back over here because this is where I planted it, remember that grapes of wrath, right? That big bush of the grapes of wrath. It's not a bush, it's a vine. Grapes don't grow on bushes. Berries do. This big vine that's being built up in the iniquity, and when it reaches its full bloom, when it reaches all the way to the top, right, what's going to happen? God's going to send His servants to harvest those grapes, and He's going to put them into that vat called the wrath of God, and they're going to press it into wine. And who's going to be made to drink it? Do you remember? Well, ultimately, but there in Revelation, the first person that gets it, what's that? It goes to the beast. It goes to that scarlet woman, or woman dressed in scarlet, and she has to drink of it, of the iniquities that she's brought. But then it also trickles down to the individuals who received that mark of the beast, right? It's that same principle. It's not just to the major people, the major players who are causing all this unrest and all these issues. It trickles down because there is not an individual who was part and parcel to this that is not guilty, right? They did not take part in this. And so they took part in Rome's debauchery and in the persecution of Christians. Then they'll take possession, they'll take a part of the wrath of God that comes upon them. And that's essentially what he's saying here in verse 12. That these individuals, all this is doing, and ultimately the culmination of all these things, is to prove and establish what God already knows. I mean, does God know those who are His and those who are not His?
Yes.
And so this debauchery and this evil that's going on, this lawless one who's leading the people astray, were their hearts already gone from God? This is just the latest thing. This is just the last thing. And I don't mean that this is the most recent thing, the most current thing, this most current fad and sin and iniquity that they've followed along with. Because their heart didn't belong to God. Or they would have done what?
They would have believed the truth
and not fallen into that unrighteousness. So it's those individuals whose hearts are already don't belong to God, already consumed with evil and sin, that are being won over and ultimately purchased by the devil. By Satan. Okay, so we've got some things along the left column. Verse 4, this group of individuals opposes God. Exalts himself above God, and I made sure to put that in lowercase. Sits as God in the temple, and we discussed that's probably a reference to the heart of the people, right? He's winning over the hearts of man. In verse 8, he's consumed with the breath of... And I even made the mistake of capitalizing his mouth there. Sorry about that. He's consumed by the breath of the Lord's mouth, whoever that is. He's destroyed with the brightness of His coming. Did it again. Verse 9 tells us that His coming is according to the work of Satan. That He comes with power, signs, and lying wonders. These are all important aspects. In verse 10... The unrighteous deception that goes out of him goes towards those who are perishing, or is among those who are perishing, and those who did not receive the love of the truth. And then verse 3, which is an interesting section there, possibly because of the way it's worded there in verse 3, remember he says, unless the falling away comes first and the Son of Man is revealed, the son of perdition. It's possible that and we mentioned this last week, it's not necessarily the case that the falling away is going to happen before the other two things he's talking about, but it is possible that's what he meant by it, right? We can't just go, oh, this must be the case, but it is possible that it's the case. So we're going to allow the possibility that that's an issue as well, and we're going to go from there. So, two things, as far as I can tell scripturally, are prophesied beyond the writing of the New Testament, or at least most of the New Testament. As far as Paul is writing here in 54 AD, 53, 54, 55, depending on where you place the book of 2 Thessalonians, there are very few huge, major events that are going to happen. One is going to happen in about 16 years. And what would that be? Bingo. The destruction of Jerusalem, which is prophesied there in Matthew chapter 24, which we'll talk about in a second. The other is what's taking place as we're talking about in Revelation, which is the prophecy that who would ultimately come? Do you remember the guy's name?
Domitian.
Yeah. The eighth horn, the bloody lintel of Nero, right? Nero reincarnated. Outside of those two, there are no other prophecies concerning beyond the writings here that Paul has. Does that mean that this isn't a new one? Is it something different that he's talking about? Not at all. He could be talking any number of things that could be going on. Unfortunately, we don't have, again, that discussion that he had with the Christians at the time. So as we open up, we're going to move fairly quickly here. In Daniel chapter 11, in verse 31, and if you remember our study in Daniel, parallel passages concerning there in Matthew 24. In Daniel 11 and verse 31, and I think you'll pick that up along the way. Daniel 11, verse 31, he says, "And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation." And if you go forward to Matthew 24, Jesus specifically quotes this passage. Now, they're not talking specifically about the same two things, because Daniel here is talking about a man named Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who would come on during the later stages of Grecian power, and he would come in and he would beat up the Jews there in Jerusalem, and he would do an abominable thing. He would sacrifice a pig on the altar, which was horrible. It was grotesque. It was beyond comprehension to the Jews. And that began what's called the Maccabean Revolt and 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which is considered Catholic doctrine, but ultimately it seems like a really good history, as far as that's concerned, dictates or describes the Maccabean family coming in and guerrilla warfare fighting back. And that's what Daniel's talking about. Jesus is using a similar analogy, talking about another army, which is the metaphor he's using. When he says the abomination of desolation, they all knew what he meant. Because Daniel was talking about an army coming in and destroying Jerusalem. And so when Jesus says that, they understand an army coming in destroying Jerusalem. And so this abomination of desolation is standing against God. In verse 36, here in Daniel chapter 11 as well. "Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done." It's very similar to the speech that Paul himself uses, and the very essence of the nature of Paul's speech, though Paul would obviously be speaking in Greek, and Daniel here, obviously, either in Hebrew or Aramaic, and I can't remember which at this point. I'm pretty sure it's Hebrew. Portions of Daniel are written in Aramaic, just so you know. So Daniel 11, 36 through 37, he exalts himself above God and everything that could be worshipped or would be worshipped. If we go back to Matthew 24, Matthew 24 and verse 5, he says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in..." 24 and verse 15. Where's the abomination of desolation standing? In the holy place. What'd you say?
In the holy place.
Yeah, he's standing in the holy place. So he sits as God in the temple. We go down, and verse 8, the first half, and that's why I have a question mark there, consumed with the breath of his mouth, and that his obviously isn't supposed to be capitalized. I don't know. That passage or that part of the prophecy, and that's why I say I don't know who it is, ultimately. We can speculate, and we can go through the passages that kind of connect, and we can see what connects closer and what connects further away. And if you guys have ideas along the way of what this might mean as far as Vespasian coming and ultimately Titus destroying the temple in 70 AD, feel free to add it, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, but this is the most I came up with so far. Destroyed with the brightness of his coming, Matthew 24 and verse 29. Notice in verse 29 he says, "Immediately after the tribulation in those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heaven will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." So there would be a day that this would be destroyed, and he describes it in a similar context there with the brightness of his coming, right? The stars will fall from the heavens and the power of the heavens will be shaken. Let's see. Yeah. Verse 9 is really the biggest issue that I have with the abomination of desolation being the it prophesying the that 2 Thessalonians 2 prophesying the coming destruction of Jerusalem is just that, according to the working of Satan, doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because ultimately the destruction of Jerusalem was God's working. You could elaborate that ultimately the issues in the temple were Satan's doing, that all of this was brought about, that God had to destroy the temple, not just because it needed to be destroyed to set the standard for Christianity. It's time for Christians now, not for Jews, right? But ultimately, the wickedness going on in the temple and the wickedness in Jerusalem was Satan's doing. So that's really where it goes kind of hokey. I don't know. With power, signs, and lying wonders, we saw there in verse 30. Unrighteous deception among those who perish. This works really well because the Jews at the time, they thought that the walls of Jerusalem would stand, and yet the Christians who knew better, because Jesus had already warned them, what did they do? They flee. So those who were perished had believed the unrighteous lies that the people of the city and ultimately were going around. They believed it. Instead of believing Jesus, they didn't believe the truth and they didn't love the truth and they perished. And those who didn't perish believed the truth, so they fled, right? And then possibly preceded by the falling away, Matthew 24 and verse 11. He says, "Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, and the love of many will grow cold." Falling away. Right? So, I think the closest rendition is between the abomination of desolation here, and then what we'll talk about in just a second, which is Domitian, the eighth horn. And if you wanted to go through the passages, Revelation 17, 13, and then 19, I don't think we have time right now. The Domitian side actually is pretty self-explanatory. The passages line up really well. And by my count, technically there are more on Domitian side, but what does that really matter? Domitian obviously coming from the working of Satan. They would come with power, signs, and lying wonders. Remember, the second beast itself was specifically for that purpose, was trying to establish emperor worship and maintain it amongst the people, that he was above all else. In Revelation 19, verses 11 through 15, the two beasts are consumed by the breath of his mouth. Remember what comes out of Jesus' mouth before there in Matthew 19? The sword, right? The sword, which is the Word of God. So what ultimately destroys evil? What ultimately destroys sin? God's Word, metaphorically speaking. And he was destroyed with the brightness of his coming. Revelation 13, 3 and 8, ultimately you have people who are receiving the mark of the beast. So those who are perishing are those who have been convinced by the beast to follow him and his evils. So Now, I'll tell you, I left that last side blank because you can fill in whatever you think. Some people put the Catholic Church in there, but scripturally speaking, there's no establishing that, just as there's no establishing any one particular view. What we don't have is enough information from Paul. That's pretty much where we're at.
Does it make you think of that, though?
It does, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I didn't fill it in only because you could put in a bunch of stuff. There are, and that's what Mr. Jim had said last week, was that, you know, the Catholic Church fits here, though scripturally you don't have any other passages to go to because nowhere else talks about potentially the Catholic Church. But then you'd also have... Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also further out than any of these others. You know, the 70 AD destruction of Jerusalem, or Domitian coming upon the scene, estimated through Revelation. There's a ton of them, though. I mean, there's more than I can count on all 20 of my digits. So, and I'd take off my shoes. I mean, that's a lot. So, if you have questions or if you have thoughts, I'd be interested to hear them. I mean, how any of them particularly fit in. If you're going to, I'd love for you to fill it in, though. That'd be awesome. Or if you have spots where you'd like to fill in on mine, whether it's the abomination of desolation or Domitian, you see passages that kind of fit in, let me know. I'd be interested. Yes, Daniel. Yeah, or David.
When you say about the floodgate, the reason that I think there's thousands of years now with Christians to reopen because it's just like the other day, I have never heard of a woman named Lilith in my whole life.
Yeah.
The reason I brought it up because out of all the time I've ever studied the Bible, I've always heard of Adam and Eve only. You know, that's the first two people that was here, period. But then, since I have been reading the Bible, I noticed that it seemed like somebody always seemed to like try to find some other word to try to let me know somebody else in. So, and that's still a battle. That's why the floodgates haven't opened, to see how many people would actually give in to the other sins before you will actually, you know, think that this is true. But they make it sound so exciting to the point where, you know, it's like a mystery and you have to try to sit there and try to figure it out.
Yeah. And that's ultimately what Mr. Jim was talking about last week, is that there are so many things that fit into this genre, this exact, you know, specifications, that people are continuing to come up with nonsense that are leading people away who are just not founded and loving the Word of God. And that's all it takes. And it's a constant battle that we're constantly in. There's never going to be a day where there's not individuals who are trying to lead us away and into pastures of you know, snake grass. Instead, we need to follow the Lord into those pastures that are green and beside the still waters. So, very good, David. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Jim. Any other questions you have, feel free to let me know, or any comments that you'd like to make. Thank you very much, though, for your attention.